Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to Cutting the Curd, broadcasting live on the Heritage Radio Network in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It's getting chilly here in New York, and as the weather starts to change, got us thinking about summer versus winter in terms of animal feed and how the seasonal changes in diet can affect the cheese. With that in mind, we have a really special episode today. I'm happy to have Matteo Keeler on the line from Greensboro, Vermont. Thanks so much for coming on, Matteo.
Awesome. Great to be here.
Yeah, man. For those of you who don't know, Matteo and his brother Andy are the proprietors of Jasper Hill Farm and the sellers at Jasper Hill, who produce and age some of America's modern classic and multiple award-winning cheeses like Moses Sleeper, Bailey Hayes in Blue, Harbison, and Winnemere. These guys have managed to change the landscape of artisan cheesemaking in the U.S., and they continue to innovate while maintaining a focus on tradition and quality. Today we're going to talk a bit about some of those innovations, but first, Matteo, I wanted to debunk some myths about summer versus winter feed and what that means for the cheese we see at different times of the year. I think most people tuning in know that what the animals are eating matter in terms of what the cheese is going to taste like, and I think we all imagine cows from an artisan dairy such as your own grazing on these endless fields of grass in the summertime and then perhaps eating hay in the wintertime. And this word grass, or this term grass-fed, is definitely one of those buzz terms that people no one asks for. But maybe if you could summarize some of the main takeaway points in how a cow's diet changes over the year and what that means for the cheese, what would those points be?
Sure. Well, every cheese is unique. It's essentially some of the practices on a farm that goes for commodity milk and kind of industrial farming to alpine alpage type production up in Switzerland, France, and Italy. And now we fall somewhere in the midst of all that. We milk 45 cows.
Yep.
On our farm in Greensboro, and we use an intensive rotational grazing approach through the spring and summer months and into the early fall. At this point, up here in northern Vermont, the grass has stopped growing. We've had some snow up here already.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
the cows are in the barn for the rest of the winter, and so our grazing period is quite short, and we get amazing growth through June, July. By the end of August, the grass is starting to slow down. September can really be marginal, and our season on grass is over by the end of September, early October, depending on the weather. At that point, our cows are going in, and they're fed a ration of dry hay, which we're producing here in the neighborhood, and that dry hay is about as good a feed for cheese making, particularly if you're making raw milk cheese, as you can get. And we'll talk about some microbiology here in a little while, but Our ration consists of dry hay with some supplemental grain. You know, we don't feed any corn silage.
Okay.
We don't feed any fermented feed. So, you know, what we find is that whether a cow is out on pasture or eating hay in a barn, there is some supplemental energy required, and that's why we're feeding some limited amounts of grain, is basically to help the cow metabolize the protein and convert those proteins into milk proteins. That requires some energy, and it can be very difficult for a dairy cow to do that efficiently without a little grain.
What's your biggest challenge, you know, is when you transition from the pasture to the hay?
You know, honestly, I think the biggest challenges we face are on the shoulder seasons and in the midst of summer, because you know, making cheese on pasture is very complicated in that you're inserting a lot of different complexity. You've got weather. It's very hard to measure what a cow's like dry matter intake might be. So ultimately, you know, grass is 90% water, right? And the quality of the forage out in the pasture can change a lot over the course of a season. And so, you know, managing the nutrition of a cow that's, you know, out loose in the field and maybe feeling hot
and bothered
his in the middle of the summer, or if you get a lot of rain, you know, she might be eating feed that where the nutrients have been like leached out of the plant just because of the amount of rain. For instance, in June this year, we got 18 inches of rain up here in the month of June.
Jesus.
And so, you know, when a cow is in the barn, you can really manage, you know, her intake carefully. And, you know, essentially we have a herd of hand-fed cows at Jasper Hill. That's not possible when they're out on pasture. They're picking and choosing what they're going to eat. And you have, like, the weather the quality of the grass in different paddocks or different parts of the farm is different as well. And so, you know, it gets a lot more complicated to turn that milk into cheese because you have a raw material that's a little different every day.
So what's the real benefit of the grass then? I mean, is it in the flavor? Is it in the end product? I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on there and a lot of variables.
A benefit in the cost. You know, the cow's out there feeding herself, right?
Sure.
So, you know, the cost of that feed that's as efficient as you can get, is sending a cow out to feed herself.
Makes sense.
Right? There are, you know, the microbiology of milk produced on pasture is slightly different. So you're going to have cheeses that may have some like a different diversity of species that you might not find in the barn. As cows lay down out in the pasture, they're picking up microbes and transporting them back to the barn. Summer cheeses, and you see this specifically with like Alpine type cheeses, generally has more complexity, and that complexity is really linked to the microbial ecology of that raw milk. And of course, there's a color. You know, grass.
It's all yellow and buttery.
Yeah, it's full of beta carotenes, and the color of the cheese changes pretty radically, and particularly in that first flush of spring grass. So those are all interesting contributors. You know, I would say that you have to be a better cheesemaker to make cheese on grass, and you're going to need to be able to celebrate some diversity both in the flavor and textural characteristics of a cheese because you're dealing with a raw material that isn't static, right?
Sure.
It's changing every day.
Sure. It's always, whenever I think of Alpine cheeses, I always think of all of those flowers, you know, or like that, you know, those classic commercials or what of like the, yeah, you know, the Ricola commercials and all that. And I've been lucky enough to be up there. But is it the microbes that are it? Do those flowers, is all of those crazy fauna up there, is that affecting the flavor, or is it all microbial activity, or is it both?
No, I would say it's definitely a combination of both. There's an interesting study that was done in Sicily a few years ago where they took an instrument, a sniffer, that was able to detect, aromas in cheese, and they actually were able to tie the aromas that they're finding in these raw milk cheeses back to specific plants that cows were feeding on in the pasture. So there is an aromatic and sensory contribution from the plants that are being consumed by animals on pasture.
Yeah.
But then there's also the microbiology, and that's an amazing thing about cheese is it's a sum of so many different complex systems, and ultimately that's why cheese is made here, there, and everywhere have their own unique character.
Yeah.
One of the things that I wanted to just say is that specifically with raw milk cheese. You can't expect the cheese to be like exactly the way you had it last.
Certainly,
right? It's like there's a vintage in a sense.
Yeah,
and every day we have a vintage through through the grazing season. So I always like to try and celebrate, the diversity that you can find within a specific cheese. Over the course of a season.
Right, because you want it to be unique within a certain set of parameters, and you control those parameters by making sure the science is proper, and you celebrate the nuances in like what those animals were eating and how it was, correct? I mean, is that
exactly?
Yeah,
yep, exactly. And every now and then we get what we call a snowflake.
Sure.
It's like a cheese. It might be like a Bailey. It looks like a Bailey. The texture might be like the way you would expect a Bailey to taste, but the flavor profile is just, it's just different. It's different, and that's really exciting for us when we can actually find batches of cheese within our range that like really stand out as being unique, and we can celebrate them and the raw milk that they're made from.
Yeah, and as a cheesemonger, we love those like windfall days too. When you open up that cheese and you think you know what it is, and it's just a little bit different. When it comes all the way down to the customers, it gets challenging sometimes because you sell them something and you're so jazzed about it because it's got that unique quality, and then it's gone. And to explain to them that it's always going to be different. Some people get it and some people don't, but I mean, that's why we do what we do, man,
Yeah.
So you mentioned you use in the winter after you pass that shoulder of transition, you use dry hay versus fermented hay. And you just constructed a new hay dryer up there, right?
Yeah, that's right. So we built a facility to dry all our forages, we're now managing two farms. We've got Jasper Hill Farm and we've got Andersonville Farm, which is up the road from us about 8 miles. And we're milking about 150 cows there, and we transitioned that farm away from silage and corn silage to dry hay. So those cows are all being fed a dry ration as well. And this facility is based on an approach that we saw in Reggio Emilia. So Parmigiano Reggiano is produced from milk from cows that have only eaten dry forages as well.
Why dry? Why is that important?
Fermented feeds like silage and, you know, the like marshmallow bales, and you can put bales in tubes, and you can chop it and put it in bunks. Silage, whether it's made from grass or corn.
A lot of corn I've seen.
Is fermented. And that fermentation involves a lot of microbes. And depending on the type of cheese that you're making, you know, that those microbes can cause all kinds of mayhem. You know, so a lot of hard-cooked pressed cheeses specifically, you know, Gruyere, Comté, Parmigiano Reggiano, prohibit the use of silage because they silage tends to have a lot of Clostridium tyrobutyricum. So butyrics are a class of microbes that are gas formers, and you can have incredibly small number of spores that can survive pasteurization even, and then begin to grow in the cheese when the cheese is, you know, 4, 5, 6 months old, and that cheese will just blow up like a basketball.
I've seen that.
Yeah, you'll start to have, like, splits and cracks in the cheese, and these butyrics produce hydrogen sulfide gas, so smells like farts and
farts,
kind
man.
Of generally unpleasant, you know, aroma profile there.
Fart profile. That's it's not, no one wants the fart profile.
Yeah. But, you know, there are also food safety considerations.
Right.
You know, you get a lot of listeria that grows in silage. It's a moist, you know, nutrient, a rich environment. And, you know, the microbiology in raw milk is the sum of the practices on a farm. So how you bed your cows, how you feed your cows, how you milk them, what your protocols are, how your cleaning protocols, the type of equipment, the design of your facility, all contribute to the microbial ecology in your raw milk. And changing any one of those things can really alter a community. And so, you know, when you shift the feeding regimen from fermented feed to dry hay, you really alter the microbial ecology in the milk. And so, you know, for us, feeding dry hay is really about ensuring that we have safe, delicious milk with the right kind of mix of microbes that can contribute to the kinds of qualities we want to see in our cheeses.
Yeah, it seems so. I mean, to a layman like me, it seems like, you know, more moisture lends itself towards a more anaerobic environment, more water, less oxygen, and I mean, it's unfortunately, I understand it from my own gross perspective, you know, but I get what you're saying. And there's got to be a cost there. I mean, you know, you say the hay itself is expensive in comparison to letting the cows out there to graze on their own. I mean, what did you guys do before you had the hay dryer? I mean, how did you get the hay for the cattle then?
Well, we purchased all our feed before then. So, you know, we were buying dry hay from Quebec primarily, and from our neighbors. You know, Quebec isn't that far from us. It's like
it isn't.
Miles. So.
It seems far away when you without that, but you're up there. So
yeah, we're way up here, you know, different years that presented like a significant expense for our business. You know, so we're able to control quality in a way that we've never been able to, and we can also manage our costs as well. You know, the feed that we put up this past summer, it's the rainiest summer we've seen in a long time. Is the most beautiful hay we've ever seen, and I guess my point is that to some extent, you know, you can't pay for the kind of feed that we're producing now. So it's pretty exciting.
That's awesome. That's just benefits all around. I mean, you pay less and you get a better product. You can't really ask for much more than that.
We're psyched.
Awesome. Well, we're going to take a short break and then we're going to come back and talk to Mateo a little bit more. Thanks a lot.
Awesome.
The Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board are proud to underwrite Cutting the Curd on heritageradionetwork.org. Wisconsin cheeses have an illustrious heritage of more than 170 years of quality and craftsmanship. During this long and rich history, the art and science of cheesemaking have been captured in time-honored traditions that produce cheese varieties of unsurpassed excellence. Today, Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit www.eatwisconsincheese.com.
Cider Week helps to bring profitability to local orchards while reviving heirloom apple varieties by cultivating awareness of craft cider. Cider Week connects cider makers from New York State and select pioneering guest cideries outside the state to buyers from top restaurants, bars, and retail shops across New York City. Those culinary tastemakers, in turn, help increase consumer awareness of cider's pleasures by hosting public events, tastings, dinners, classes, and pairings that build appreciation and demand for regional ciders.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. We're talking to Mateo Keeler of Jasper Hill. If you have any comments or questions about anything we're talking about today, be sure to comment on our show page at heritageradionetwork.org. As we heard in the first half of the show, it's pretty common, even during summer months, to supplement a herd's grass-based diet with a grain in order to balance both cow nutrition and the ultimate milk quality. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about something else. I wanted to talk about GMOs and how the increased desire nationally for labeling of GMO ingredients is affecting cheesemakers. For those of you who don't know, GMOs, or genetically modified organisms, are living organisms whose genetic material have been manipulated in a lab through genetic engineering. Companies like Whole Foods committing to labeling all products made with GMO ingredients by 2018. This is certainly going to have an impact on the cheese industry, like in cases where farmers are using GMO feed to supplement their animals' diets. Just for context, more than 90% of corn and soy today are now genetically engineered in the States. So, Mateo, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about your decision to source non-GMO rations for your animals and the challenges in getting there.
Well, it's been incredibly complicated to figure out how to manage a transition. The fact of the matter is that the real costs of genetic engineering haven't really been realized. I think, you know, what we're experiencing is that there are all these identity-preserved supply chains, that's what they're called, identity-preserved supply chains that are going to need to be built in order to connect the seed that goes in the ground through, you know, the entire value chain right to the end consumer. And the amount of traceability, the testing, the costs associated with that are going to be staggering for our economy over the next 10 years. When we started at this, we went and asked our feed mill if they'd be willing to sell us a non-GMO, ration, and they laughed at us. And we internally made the decision based on, you know, having our fingers on the pulse of where the market is going to a large extent, and also seeing the impacts of GMO corn specifically in our community. 10 years ago, there's nobody growing corn up here in northern Vermont.
Right.
And at this point, you know, the small farms are all disappearing. Larger farms are moving in, milking a lot more cows than, the land traditionally could have handled, and they're able to do that because they can grow these varieties of corn. It's not the genetic engineering that we have an issue with per se. I think that there are lots of opportunities for really awesome application of that technology. What's difficult is engineering seeds that enable like mass application of like herbicides.
Yeah.
And so, we're coming at this from both like an ethical place and from an pragmatic economic place. And what we ended up doing is going out and designing and costing out a feed mill and working out like the logistics for getting train car quantities of non-GMO grain delivered to Vermont. And thank goodness we haven't had to do that. We were able to persuade Morrison's Custom Feeds, the only organic supplier of grains in northern Vermont here, to give it a shot. And it's fascinating because it's not that the non-GMO grain isn't out there, because it is, and it's trading at similar prices, slightly more expensive than like conventional GMO grains on commodity markets. It's the distribution to the farm level that doesn't exist, right? So basically,
where does it go then? I mean, what do you mean by that?
Oh, right. So the U.S. produces tons of non-GMO grains. They're all being exported, right?
Yeah, of course.
Right, so they're going down the Mississippi River. They're going north up to the St. Lawrence, and they're going to Europe and China. They're going all over the world. We're producing lots of non-GMO grain. It's just that the processing and distribution to the farm level it's not there.
Can it be there, or is it just something that hasn't happened yet, or is it just economics in the way of that?
We're part of a working group that's looking at this problem on a supply chain wide basis, and it's going to take 5 to 10 years to shift the supply chain, and to a large extent, the costs are going in dairy are going to be associated with having to segregate milk within a cheese plant. So you're going to have like trucks driving past one farm picking up milk at a non-GMO farm, then driving past three more farms and picking up milk, and then bringing it back to a plant where it has to have its own silo and it has to be processed separately from everything else in the plant. And so, the co-ops are looking at this and going, oh my God, how are we going to like deal with this?
It's a lot to manage, dude.
Yeah, and the farmers are all going, what? You're going to take away my technology over my dead body? We're sure. Living in a time where commodity milk prices are just terrible, and so these GMO, these traded seeds are they have real benefits for the farmer. They're very convenient to grow, and so I don't know how this is all going to work out. For us, we've been able to source non-GMO verified ingredients and have them turned into pellets at a mill and delivered to our farm. And so we started that transition in July. And we don't grow any corn or feed any corn, so we're basically a grass-based dairy otherwise. And so for us, this transition is more simple than a farmer that's actually relying on corn or corn silage as part of their ration.
Sure. And just to speak to what you said about just the environmental impact, or just made me think about The last time I traveled to Italy, which wasn't this year for Bra, it was the last time, and I was up north in Piedmont, and I hadn't been there in a few years, and it just seemed like every pasture, everything that I went by was a cornfield now. You know, like I don't know if that was part of what you're talking about, but I noticed it, and it was just pretty stark, you know? And I asked the guy who I was with, I was like, so what the heck is this all about? And he was like, yeah, it's all corn and it's all for fuel. You know, I was like, yeah. Corn is just, dude, corn is everywhere, man. It's very free.
It's really taking over. You know, and, our issue is really with Roundup specifically.
Sure.
It's the herbicide that's basically sprayed to kill all the like grass and underlying vegetation to support that corn. You know, in BT corn in the south, you know, you couldn't grow corn some years in the southern United States without a genetically modified seed that allows a plant to express you know, a toxin. And it used to be, you know, you'd spray chemicals on the outside of the plant. Now they've engineered them so that they can express a toxin in every cell of the plant. And I don't know. I think that over the next few years, we're going to see the science catch up to the technology, and I wouldn't be surprised if there does turn out to be some consequences from a health perspective to the introduction of some of these seeds.
But it just sounds like what you're saying is that it's less about the inherent danger of genetically modified organisms in terms of the health of humans and a lot about the environmental impact of using them, it seems to me. But I mean, would you say that's pretty accurate? Or
yeah, I think that the science at this point is inconclusive on the health, the animal and human health. But it's been hard because there's intellectual property restrictions on independent research, on some of these traded, on some of the genes that are inserted and the consequences there. And I think that, you know, one of the issues is that we don't know what we don't know. And in this country, our approach, whether it's, you know, leaded gasoline or DDT or, you know, different versions of birth control over the years, is to embrace the technology and then allow the science to catch up and the consequences to become apparent, and then the regulation kicks in. And, you know, that's the way that we regulate technology in this country, and we'll see what happens with, you know, some of these genetically modified organisms, you know, over the next few years as the science really starts to, peel back the layers, so to speak.
So is the price of your cheese going to go up because of all this?
It is. We figure that it costs us about almost $4 per 100 pounds of milk in increased cost of the grain. So there's a slight reduction in the yield and there's a pretty significant increase in the cost. And we translate that into per pound increase that we figure is going to be somewhere between 40 and 50 cents a pound.
Wow.
So we started increasing our price this past July when we started feeding the grain, and we're trying to make it incremental in such a way. And ultimately the question is how badly do consumers want non-GMO products? Are they willing to support the increased expense in bringing these practices onto counters?
That's really what I was going to say. Is like, it really is going to be up to all of our customers to put their money where their mouth is, because everybody wants to be responsible, or I feel like, you know, people always want to be responsible. but it hits you in the wallet pretty hard, man. I mean, it's really easy to eat and to make cheap and irresponsibly constructed food products in this country. You know what I mean? It's like, it's so much easier than to make real food, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, honestly, this is the first time we've kind of waded into any kind of labeling or claim,
right,
like on the label. And our angle has always been, you know, quality. And, you know,
right,
we're not a low-cost producer.
Yep.
You know, it's unclear that, you know, this non-GMO artisan cheese is going to taste any better than it did before. But it is going to be a little more expensive. And, you know, for that reason, we're doubling down on quality and trying to make our cheeses as delicious as they've ever been, because ultimately we believe that's the only angle we really have.
Yeah, and I'm with you on that. And they are, as a retailer, your products, they're better than ever, man. So thanks a lot for that. You guys kicking ass as usual. So, you know. Well, I want to thank you so much, you know, for coming on the show today and spending a little time with us. I really totally appreciate it. And if you guys out there want to weigh in on this, please go to our show page and comment. I want you all to stay tuned next week. We'll be back, you know, for more Cutting the Curd. Thanks a lot, Mateo. And everybody,
thank
have
you,
a good
Greg.
Night. Yeah, man. Take care.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
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 Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.